This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at DLineMinutes.
This week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry along with Sam Lau.
Hey, hey.
Sam, we're recording just after the close on Friday, April 16th. Under normal circumstances, all the CPAs we know would be breathing a big sigh of relief having a tax season over, but I don't know if it's fortunately for them, it's another month longer, or unfortunately for them, they have another month of pain to come.
Well, pain is the right word for it, man. Seeing all that money exit your account certainly is painful. So hopefully Stephanie Kelton and her MMT ways will help alleviate some of that.
Yeah, hopefully.
Half jokingly.
All right. Well, let's get into the markets.
Yeah. So let's take a look here. The S&P 500 is up on a really pretty strong week. It's up almost 1.5% for the week to date and 12% on the year. It was utilities led the way, up nearly 4%. Comp services are the lone laggard with the lone negative, or I guess they're not the lone laggard, but they're the ones with the lone negative print, down 10 basis points using and borrowing from fixed income parlance. The reversal trade continues to live another week with both large cap outperforming small caps and growth outperforming value on a week-to-date basis. Catching up on a year-to-date basis as well there, it seems like, to closing the gap a little bit. So we'll see what happens there. Moving over to fixed income land, the Barclays U.S. aggregate was up 30 basis points, but still down nearly 3% on the year. All primary sectors within the ag were up on the week, led by U.S. Treasuries. The 10-year Treasury yield was down 7 basis points for the week, closing the week off at 1.59%.
Yeah, it seems like a much bigger move than just 6 basis points. But I guess, you know, if you kind of go back to the high of the year was 174 on March 31st. That's why it feels like it's a little bit of a bigger move. But, 6 basis points, you say, oh, that's not really that big of a move. But I guess when you look at the overall 15 basis points in the first couple weeks of the month, that's why it feels a little bit more.
Yeah, and as we've been discussing on the virtual desk, that move down was a little bit of a head scratcher given some of the economic prints that we saw come out this week that we'll discuss in a few minutes here. But it was definitely one of those things where you and I were talking. It seemed like the Treasury market was underwhelmed by some of the positive news, and they might have been expecting even a bigger surprise that we even saw on these retail and CPI numbers here. But yeah, it's a change of pace, let's say.
Yes. Yeah.
So moving over to the commodity land, WTI crude oil had a strong week, up just about 6.5% for the week, closing the week down, closing the week at just over $63. So it's nice to see it above that 60 mark again, as we've seen some reports around from various agencies, including OPEC and the IEA. A, which I believe stands for International Energy Association, not to be confused with the EIA, but the IEA, they all pointed to perhaps some stronger demand for energy products in the coming months.
When OPEC Plus was expanding their production and prices went up on the back of a perceived increase in demand over the summer, that seems to have been confirmed. At least some lettered agencies have confirmed that's kind of the outlook over that short term.
Yeah, so maybe this week the OPEC Plus opining again is a little bit of them talking their pipeline of production, I guess. trying to boost those prices, mayhaps. But I did see over the most recent print from the Department of Transportation, I believe, showing indications that highway traffic is back up to pre-pandemic levels. So that could have something to do with that as well.
And another thing we're just talking about too is that on Tuesday is the 1 year anniversary of the negative $37 a barrel, or negative, I guess it kept negative 42 in some, but negative 30, maybe 42 at the low lows, close at negative $37 a barrel. So if we can keep this $63-ish a barrel, your on Tuesday your year over year price change will be $100 a barrel.
Yes, the infamous April 20th, 2020 date, where WTI crude oil front month futures traded negative. And you, me, and Jeff Sherman on the Sherman Show podcast were talking about, you know, ways to take advantage of that, including dumping some taking delivery and taking some crude oil and storing it in our backyard pools there. So
in your backyard pool.
Yeah. That's true. Trying to think of ways to profit from that, given that the administration did not buy for the strategic petroleum reserves at a negative price back then. You know, we wanted to help the economy by generating some demand. But moving over to, let's see here, I guess we left off with crude. So let's move over to gold. Gold's up over 2%, getting closer to that 1800 mark once again. So see if this direction holds here. And then broad commodities overall had a strong showing, up about 3% on the week for closing off the year to date here for through Friday at just about 11% up as measured by the Bloomberg Commodity Index. So that wraps up the market portion. Do you want to kick us off on a little bit of recap on the macro?
Yeah, I think the big news out of there was a couple big prints out of the week. The first one was on Tuesday. The CPI number, the consumer price index number, came out. This was the first kind of look into how things were going to look after the base effects came through. Headline CPI came in slightly more than expected at 0.6% versus consensus. So it was supposed to be 50 basis points. Core CPI, so that is excluding food and energy, was also up a little bit higher than expected, but really did not move the market. The market did not react to this headline. So they're believing that this inflation that we're seeing is transitory, and that it's really something that the Fed has put out enough information that the market is kind of a non-believer in kind of sustained inflation at least at this level and at least at this point in time.
Yeah, I would say the bulk of the move up for CPI was in the energy complex, which a lot of people tend to poo-poo, but it is a big piece of the overall consumer basket with regards to if you think about what you spend on. But I think one area that we've been talking about in the past and, you know, we continue to monitor is owner's equivalent rent, which has been somewhat low and disappointing. But as we've discussed, the OER, as it's called by its acronym, typically lags housing prices by more than a few months. It's really about a year or so. So, you know, that's one area where we can see some upside. I don't know if it'll be surprise or not at that point, you know, given that we're talking about so much and everyone's listening to us. But the OER is where we can see some of the core service inflation pick up in the future.
Again, yeah. And again, it's going to take a few months for kind of the base effects to work themselves out. But there's going to be no shortage of analysis and commentary around inflation between now and that point in time. So I think we can safely put this to bed for this month and revisit again in a few weeks. Then also on Thursday, the retail sales came out. Everyone was looking for a big number here, and the number came out even higher than was expected. I think that we came in at almost a 10% number, 9.8% month over month. That number was expected to be around in the eights or anywhere from six to 8%. So really a pretty big broad range in terms of what the number was. It came out higher than everything that anyone was really expecting. Even the prior month revised higher. So that kind of brings it to it was a very broad based move too. So if you kind of look at all the month over month numbers, they're all in the green. So positives So not really any one sector driving a lot of the retail sales numbers, but very, very broad-based. And it was the second highest level on record after the May number from last year. So again, give people money in terms of stimulus checks and they're going to go out and spend it.
Yeah, I mean, people are definitely spending those stimmy checks, it seems like. But I guess the trillion-dollar question is if the U.S. consumer is getting addicted to this free monies that they've been getting on that periodic basis. So I think that'll be especially relevant once we have fully reopened the economy and people are back to work, and just see if people are still dependent on or looking for free stimmy checks in their pocket before they go out and unleash their spending habits. But, you know, one of the things I was looking at after, you know, Ryan Kimmel, an analyst on their multi-asset team, sends out these great summaries of various economic data prints. I was looking at it just before we started recording. And one of the things that struck me was that on a year-over-year basis, grocery stores was one of the only negative prints within this cohort of, let's say, 15 to 20 categories. And, you know, I started thinking back, and you remember how people were stocking up and even hoarding initially after the lockdown, and Sherman opened up his trading post there so we could barter for goods.
Yeah, yes.
One of the things that eggs
for toilet paper.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the things I really wanted to see, and I wish they broke out, was I'd love to see the year-over-year numbers on toilet paper sales and see how much that's declined versus that period of time when it seemed to have been in short supply.
I overheard it, or I remember hearing a number that they did $11 billion in toilet paper sales last year, and they're projected, you know, they ramped up production, and they're only projected to do $9 billion in toilet paper sales this year, so... Maybe yeah. There's an oversupply of toilet paper out there.
Yeah, or and vice versa. Hopefully, the need for toilet paper, you know, usage hasn't increased, right?
So right.
It's a lot of garbage in. So let's see. But it seems like you know, further to that point, you know, the breakdown by category, if we look at it, even on a month to month or year over year, it looks like people are spending their stimulus checks on things that make them happy. Because I just, you know, as I was perusing the Ryan Kimmel report, it just seems like most of the boost to the month over month number came from discretionary purchases over the staples. So definitely those stimulus checks are keeping consumers stimulated and making them hopefully making them happy.
Yeah, after a rough year, hopefully it is making them happy.
Yeah.
Also on Thursday, we had industrial production number. Normally we don't highlight this one. But it did come in a little bit lower than expected, but turned positive. So it had been negative for quite a while now, and it turned positive this month. Usually when it is negative, it is a decent indicator of a recession. So this is another one that has turned positive. Maybe that's a signal that we are getting out or out of the recession. Remains to be seen when it's going to get called officially the end of the recession. But this is another one where you look at it and say, okay, maybe we're getting out of the doldrums and into the end of the recession. And then the final data point that did get released on Thursday, so it's hard to kind of figure out if any of these moved the market or if they all moved the market together, was the total unemployment benefits claimed. That number, which we've been talking about, has been bouncing around between 18 and 20 million. But the last couple weeks have been at 18 million. And then it dropped this week to just under 17 million, so 16.9 million. So a pretty big decrease of 1.2 million for the week over week. So this is the lowest level that we've been at kind of since the pandemic began last April. So it's very positive signs. Still a long way to go, but I think if this trend can continue, should be pretty good for the jobs market.
Yeah, and hopefully we do continue to see this trend and people get employed and get those paychecks back so they can actually, you know, start spending their money. And you know, maybe that'll translate into CPI. But I guess going back on, you know, what we talked about last week, we had a cornucopia of questions. We're starting to whittle that down. So this week we are tackling part of a series of questions from one of our listeners by the name of Bobby. Bobby states and asks, let's see here, the U.S. real yield curve seems steep and steeper than the nominal yield curve. Is there anything to read into the steepness of this curve? And are there key levels of the real yields that would concern you? he later goes on to ask, again, this is a several part question, so we're just going to tackle a few of them. But he also notes that the front end of the US yield curve has moved towards pricing hikes earlier than the median Fed dot projection. What do you think the likelihood What do you think that the likelihood is that the current market pricing is realized? I'm horrible at reading here. Jeff, what are your thoughts on the real yield curve and perhaps some of the steepness that we're seeing here right now?
Yes, I mean, certainly when you look at it, it is steep. A lot of it is just based on the fact that the nominal U.S. yield curve is relatively steep, with a 2 year kind of anchored at 15-16 basis points, and the long bond at 229 basis points. So that steepness is also being reflected in the real yield curve. I think that you look at it and when you do look at it, it is negative. I would think that any switch between positive sign and negative sign is kind of the levels to look out for. I wouldn't necessarily say that, if you look at the 30-year real yield is implying, inflation being pretty stable for 30 years. If there was a volatility index of real yields, I would take the over on that volatility probably. To me, it's really much more of a reflection of the steepness in the nominal curve and the fact that people are expecting inflation to stay relatively low for the Fed to kind of control inflation, to be able to control inflation and keep it low for a long period of time, but maybe with a little bit more volatility over the short to medium term.
Yeah, and I think you make a lot of good points there. But I was going to take a step back. I think one of the things that might be helpful for listeners too is just giving a quick, I suppose, overview of where real yields come from and what the relationship is with nominal yields and just the idea of real yields. That's really it's a proxy. It's a proxy that's derived from the yield on the TIPS underlying security or treasury inflation protected securities. So real yields are basically it comes from the TIPS measure, and that is part of what goes into the thinking of nominal yield. So when you break it down, I guess you could say that nominal yields consist of the real yield, aka the TIPS yield, and a premium over that real yield to account for inflation. So I guess this differential between the nominal and real yields is really it's known as break-even rate. So when you hear Jeff and I talk about break-evens and such, it is that differential between nominal and the TIPS yield. And that's the market-based expectations for what inflation will be going forward. So, as Jeff was saying, the steepness of the nominal yield curve, and then you subtract this kind of consistent outlook by the market-based expectations of around 2.5% for headline CPI as measured for by the break-even rates across all tenors of the treasury market, then the steeper real yield curve against the nominal curve really comes against that, because you have the lower nominal yields up front that are also subtracted, from which you subtract even rate of approximately 2.5%. That gives you a very deeply negative real yield at the front end of the curve. And then as you have the positive slope nominal yield curve that goes out to the 30 year, that impact of that 2.5% expected inflation headline CPI print has less of a impact there. So, and actually when we take a look at it, as we took a look at it just earlier today, Jeff, the 30-year break-in was just hanging in at a positive print. It looks like it could break through into negative territory again, perhaps as early as next week as well. But all of this also, and I think you alluded to this, there's some distortion perhaps in the treasury market given the Fed's very visible hand through its quantitative and monetary policy. Today, quantitative easing and monetary policy, I should say. So it has a pretty heavy footprint, especially in the TIPS market, which is a significantly smaller debt market than coupon treasuries, anything 1 year and or beyond the 1 year point in the treasury curve. So the last I think we checked is the Fed holds over 20% of all TIPS outstanding. So that definitely has a hand in depressing real rate to the negative territory as well, I would think.
I think that's a good point, Sam, that, you know, anytime the Fed comes in and is buying in a market, you kind of lose a lot of the signaling that you could normally get from that, whether it's people trying to front run what the Fed is, what they think the Fed's going to buy, which could distort the markets, or, you know, the Fed just putting pressure on certain parts of the curve to put pressure on. And thank you again for taking a step back. I just get so excited to talk about real yields that, you know, I just jumped right in. But yes, a very good explanation on what I was actually talking about.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess one of the ways to think about it too, I mean, it's because he did ask what the, are there key levels of real yields that would concern you? And, you know, it's negative real yields concern me because it's destructive. It's destructive to people who are looking to save because, you know, the interest rate that you're looking to earn on your, or that you're earning on your savings can't keep up with the increases in the cost of living, right? So overall, negative real yields seem to be destructive to savers. And if you think about, you know, all the existing problems that certain, you know, that most pension funds here in the U.S. have been suffering over the course of the last decade or so, this only exacerbates it. But I suppose on the flip side, that if you were to take the other side of the coin, you could say that negative real yields probably encourage borrowing and spending. It definitely pushes people out farther in the risk curve, I would expect, as well within fixed income land, because they're trying to search for positive real yields, you know, in this 2.5% CPI type of, or expected inflation type of world. So pushing people out.
You don't think buying the long bond and getting your 3 basis points real yield over the next 30 years isn't an attractive alternative for people?
I think it fits for certain investor types, but I think for your average investor type, I think there's other places that you could look, you know, to maintain some type of investment thesis in there outside of duration. But all of this just seems to fit into the Fed's objective, right? In terms of trying to reflate the economy. Seems
yes.
like it's almost yep. by design, right? So I guess at this point, we should just be happy that only real yields are negative here in the U.S. and not the, and we still at least have some positive nominal yields for the time being, right? Although that's not always the case in the T-bill market. But, you know, for the coupon
definitely,
market,
yeah, that you know, 159 10-year looks attractive relative to zero or negative in other places around the world.
Yeah, it's all relative. That's, you know, our mantra. We're always looking at stuff on a relative basis to look for the best and most efficient use of capital.
So let's get into the second half of Bobby's question, and that was about the front end of the yield curve and pricing hikes and when really is the market, you know, my interpretation is do we think the market is going to force the Fed's hand and hike rates? And if you kind of think back to when we were looking at the interest rate probability screens and trying to figure out when the market was pricing in over a 50% probability of the Fed hiking rates, and then I think it was something like 2 months out before a Fed meeting or 6 weeks before a Fed meeting, if the market was pricing in a greater than a 50% probability of a rate hike, that soon became 100% probability of a rate hike. And so when you look at the Fed fund futures market now, so they have these futures out there that are pricing in what the path is of the Fed funds rate. If you kind of started the year in kind of mid-January, the Fed was really, they had a 50% probability of a Fed rate hike starting in, looks like January of 2023, and then no hikes through all of 2023. Kind of in February, that number moved up, and so you know, still only one hike, much higher probability though of a hike, called like an 80% probability of the Fed hiking rates in the early 2023, and then that being the only Fed rate hike for the year. And then look at it today or a couple of days ago, it's almost a 100% probability of the Fed raising rates in January 2023. Another 100% probability, almost 100% probability of a Fed rate hike later in 2023, and we get to a 50% probability of a Fed rate hike in kind of mid 2022. Now, this is very different from what the Fed is stating. Powell stated this week again that most Fed officials don't see a rate hike coming until 2024. That the market should kind of focus on focus on inflation and the jobs market, so it's not going to be anytime soon. And that also, you know, he kind of Powell was out there talking a lot this week, and he also said that the Fed's not going to raise rates before they start tapering their purchases, and they will wait until inflation has sustainably reached above 2% and the labor market has finished. He said, the quote I said, labor market has finished completely. I imagine that means that the labor market has recovered completely. And you know, from that, it seems like the market is pricing in Fed rate hikes well before, or occurring well before the Fed is thinking that they're going to hike rates. So, and when push comes to shove, historically, the market has forced the Fed's hand. And so it'll be interesting to see as we get closer to these dates. Again, but neither the Fed nor the markets are saying really any hikes this year in 2021. So we do have some time for that to kind of play out. But as we get closer and closer to the end of the year, is the Fed going to start tapering their quantitative easing, their asset purchases? Because that seems to be a prerequisite before they actually do start hiking rates.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's one of those things that the Fed has always said that it is somewhat of a moving target because they are data dependent. I guess one of the things that they neglect to say is that part of that data is the market. So I 100% agree with you there. I think that the Fed watches the market based data, and we've seen it time and time again that they do acquiesce to violent market moves, let's say there. So, I mean, one thing I would also point out in there within, you know, the timeline that you provided there is that a lot of the shift forward in market-based expectations coincides with the timing of when yields really began to accelerate on what I would call optimism around growth, economic growth here in the U.S. And that really began in February and led throughout March. So it seems like, whereas earlier I was trying to imply that the nominal Treasury yield seemed to have faded the positive and optimistic or beats on expectations for economic news this week, it seems like Fed fund futures are pricing it in. They're shifting forward this curve, as you pointed out.
Yeah, but even if you look at the, you know, that's in the Fed fund futures. If you look at the 2-year Treasury, you know, it was 11 basis points or so at the beginning of the year. It's up to 16 basis points now. But really, this month has been pretty flat. Started the month at, you know, when we did talk about the 10-year coming down by 15 basis points, the 2-year is, you know, kind of rock solid at that 16 basis point number.
Yeah. So a lot to look out for. I mean, as you know, listeners will start to gather from our attempts to answer these questions, is that everything is very nuanced, and you know, as we like to say, the market moves every second. So you know, it's always constantly evolving data points, and while we try to point to you know, things that might be a catalyst, more importantly, I think it's more beneficial for us to give people ways to think about, you know, approaching answering these questions in the future. So Bobby, I think we tackled two of your four part question there. We'll probably loop back around to the other two at some point in the coming weeks, but we just wanted to get these out first, and then hopefully answer some of the other questions that we had in the queue in some earlier weeks here. So sit tight. We'll get back to your other questions later on.
Yes, but thank you for the questions.
Thank you. Yep.
All right. So Sam, things to keep an eye on for next week. It is going to be a quiet week, you know, given the Fed. There's a Fed meeting on April 28th. So they're kind of in their blackout period. So there's not going to be Jay Powell is not going to be hitting the circuit again this week, which I guess explains why this past week he has been hitting the circuit, because he couldn't talk this week.
Yeah.
So quiet from Fed speak. On Thursday, we do get the LEI, the leading economic indicators. This should be the first time we go back positive. A large negative number from March of 2020 rolls off, so should turn back positive again. As we talked about this. This is a decently good signal when it turns negative that there's a recession coming. So in order for it to turn negative, we needed to turn positive first. So this is the first step in towards this being an indicator we can look at if or when things do turn back a little bit sour. And then on Friday, we get a market with an eye, manufacturing and services PMIs. These numbers are expected to be very strong. Last month's numbers were very strong. These are expected to be even stronger. So again, as you said, the economy seems like it's it's getting back up to speed and humming along, which is interesting given that the you know 10-year treasury did fall over this week, this past week, even though in the light of all these stronger numbers.
Yeah, and it'll be critical, I think, in these coming months, especially on the back of some of the talk on transitory inflation prints and also just rolling off the base effects here. I think it'll be very important that the economy just continues to show strength because everyone's expecting the best. But if it disappoints to the downside, I think you're going to see some pretty violent moves potentially here within some of these market measures that we go through each week.
Yeah, I think that's right, that the market is expecting, you know, optimism, strength back into the economy. So maybe the downside is you're skewed more towards the downside risks right now than kind of upside continue to grind along. But usually when you're you know, near all-time highs or at all-time high levels, that does tend to be the case.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, another good, I think it's another good podcast today, Sam. Thanks for all of our listeners for tuning in again.
Yeah, thanks everyone, and thanks for the questions that we've got. Keep them coming. As you know, so we've might be not be able to get your answer right away some weeks, but we do make every effort to get them in on a timely basis. But you heard it here first, Monday Morning Minutes. Don't forget to subscribe to us so you don't miss any future episodes. You can pick up the latest one each Monday before the bell. Monday morning, the podcast is now available, as we've said, on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. So go out and subscribe through those platforms. Don't forget to hit us up on the Twitter at our handle of D-Line Minutes, or you can hit us up on the email at minutes@doubleline.com if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions. Appreciate the feedback we've received so far.
Yeah, definitely appreciate the feedback. Keep it coming, positive and negative, as we've said. You know, good criticism is also helpful to us to try to make it more useful for our listeners. You can find more information about DoubleLine at our website, doubleline.com. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/doubleline capital. Our latest video is for those of you interested in Bitcoin and the blockchain. One of our portfolio managers, Bill Campbell, had a webcast with Blockworks on central bank digital currencies, which, you know, a lot of it's over my head, but it's something that, you know, is a very interesting and seems to be a much more a growing part of kind of the discourse out there in terms of blockchain and digital currencies.
Discord and discourse. I agree with that.
And don't forget to subscribe to our other podcast, The Sherman Show, where you can hear Sam and Jeff Sherman talk to guests every other week. You can follow that podcast on Twitter at Sherman Show Pod. Talk to everyone again next week.
Thanks, everyone.
The audio presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without express written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast and any liability therefor, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by any listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk.
Copyright 2021 DoubleLine Capital.